This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Living in the shadow of the Teflon flu.
As the Trump administration tosses regulations, PFAS, the forever chemicals, continue their killing spree. Most humans and animals already have them in our blood. Colorado Hill reporter Shara Udison on her new book, Poisoning the Well, How Forever Chemicals Contaminated America. What really moves people to climate action? Penn scientists led by Alyssa Alley Sinclair tell all in their new paper, Behavioral Interventions Motivate Action to Address Climate Change. Brain Tools on Radio EcoShock. Welcome.
Radio EcoShock.
From Teflon pans to firefighting foam, stable chemicals that don't burn or stick to anything are great. People sprayed PFAS-type products on couches for stain resistance. We welcomed them in because governments, corporations, and the military all hid their studies showing PFAS chemicals cause lots of cancer and a whole host of other deadly conditions. You have some in your body. They build up over the years. Communities downstream from production facilities and military bases have been literally decimated. Activists can take you on a death tour, pointing out each house and the family members lost. Millions of us in many countries are drinking these chemicals, even though reverse osmosis technology can remove them. Of course, that means the new Make America Healthy Again crowd in the Trump administration just has to gut any rules controlling these chemicals. That was announced just last week. In response, uber-popular YouTuber channel Veritasium launched a video doc on May 14th, how one company secretly poisoned the planet. 2 weeks later, it had 13 million views and counting. As reported in Scientific American, May 28th, YouTube science star Derek Muller confronts PFAS, forever chemicals, in his own blood. Let's go in depth with reporters just back from the front, Cancer Alley to Peterson Space Force Base in Colorado. A bomb with fallout that never decays has already exploded over the United States and the world. It is a chemical bomb, and like radiation, it leads to cancer and many other deadly diseases. Almost all of us have some of it in our blood and organs. Our pets, wildlife, and even seals at the poles have them. PFASs, the forever chemicals. Tainted drinking water is hot news these days. Recent headlines announce regulations trying to control PFASs. How fortunate. Two dogged reporters just released their new book, Poisoning the Well, How Forever Chemicals Contaminated America. One author is Rachel Frazin, covering energy and environment policy for The Hill. The other is Columbia journalism grad and Hill, Colorado reporter from Colorado, Sharon Udison. Welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for having me.
Corporate denial, regulatory failure, veterans' health, social justice, this story has it all, unfortunately. Please explain what these chemicals are and why they proliferate into our lives.
Well, PFAS, or PFAS as we call them, it's an acronym for about 15,000 synthetic organofluorines. They're called per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances. Now, again, I said synthetic, so that means these are all man-made. And that number only increases every day, that 15,000 that I said. And they're in many household items, such as waterproof fabric, nonstick pans, cosmetics, certain firefighting foams. I bet every person listening to this right now has either some PFAS in a garment they're wearing or in cosmetics they're wearing or in food packaging they use today. And these compounds have water and stain-resistant properties that have made them incredibly useful over time as well, useful in medical devices, things like heart stents or first responder gear, and also in semiconductors. Now, that all sounds great, but the problem is these compounds don't break down in the environment, literally at all. And they also linger in the human body, sometimes for years, by binding to proteins in the blood. And the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, says that they are in at least the blood of 97% of United States residents, for example. But that's really representative of the entire world because this is a planetary issue. And they've been linked to numerous cancers and serious diseases of the kidney, thyroid, heart, reproductive issues, immune issues, and downstream from where these discharges occur in industry, effects can just really be dire.
And when did corporate producers like 3M and DuPont discover their products were hazardous and spreading widely?
You know what? I will start with their creation just to give you some time scale here. They were accidentally created in industry in 1938, and I say accidentally because it was basically a postdoc in DuPont in New Jersey who was working on a replacement for hazardous refrigerants, and he basically came upon a white powder called, which DuPont eventually called PTFE, poly-TFE, or Teflon, in 1944. And then that very quickly had military applications because this was a material that was resistant to heat and corrosion. It didn't interact with other chemicals, didn't stick to anything. So the military decided to use it to contain highly reactive materials like uranium in the making of the atom bomb. And then it kind of took off in a lot of different directions. A French inventor began coating pans with Teflon and started his own company, Tefal, in France again, in 1956. And then that became an export to the United States in 1961. So that's when it started really being popularized in the United States. And also around that time was when it became clear, well, it's clear to us now, that the companies and the government as well was also looking into the toxicological effects of these things. There are several examples, you know, going back to like the 1950s, researchers, for example, in and outside of DuPont found that some people exposed to heated Teflon developed flu-like effects that was called polymer fume fever. There was other things, like in 1959, there was an FDA official who wrote that Teflon might be, quote, unstable under cooking temperatures and that some decomposition products are quite toxic. And yet that same FDA approved Teflon-coated cookware. So all the way back then, so that's around the 50s, there was some research happening in the background. And that research really continued for decades. And the public really was broadly unaware of this.
And the other arm of this beast involves the military. What is going on there?
So 3M, which was another PFAS producer, and the Navy decided that these materials could really have other applications broadly in the military, and eventually this actually extended to militaries across the world, and that is with the use of a foam, or the creation of a foam called AFFF. It's an acronym for a long name. And this foam was used to suppress jet fuel-based fires. And the Navy and 3M really developed it together starting in the 1960s. But by 1979, AFFF was present at more than 90 U.S. civilian airports as well. And hundreds of military sites were in the U.S., we're using foam in emergencies and training drills. So that was just the U.S. Like, imagine if you look at the entire world. But at the same time, just like industry and just like the government, the military was also researching the toxicological effects. There's reports that we found saying, for example, in 1971, a military report cited a certain type of PFAS as a possible threat to fish, called it a serious pollutant that didn't break down. 1985, a report at one of the bases that we looked at in Colorado labeled AFFF as hazardous. And I could go on and on, but they too were looking in to these effects.
Are veterans and their families suffering from widespread diseases, possibly from these chemicals? Are they getting the help they need?
We took a look at, in this book, in Poisoning the Well, we looked at four different communities around the country that each have a distinct from each other problem related to PFAS, and one of those was a military community, and that was in El Paso County, Colorado, which is south of Colorado Springs, about 2 hours south from where I'm talking to you right now, which is in Boulder, Colorado. And There's a massive military presence in that region. And we took this region as an example of what could be said for many other military communities across the country. It really epitomizes a lot of other places. And this region, in that county, El Paso County, there are about 45,000 military personnel, 15,000 federal workers, and 90,000 veterans residing there, because there's Peterson Space Force Base, the U.S. Air Force Academy, and U.S. Army's Fort Carson. So there's just a huge military presence. Like, everyone knows someone who works for the military in that community. And one of the main, I'll call the main character kind of protagonist families we focused on were the Favors / Patterson family, in which more than 24 relatives have suffered from serious illnesses that they attribute to PFAS releases from the bases. And at least 5 of those people have suffered from kidney-related diseases. And I will point out that a lot of these people are not related to each other. They're in-laws, they're cousins of in-laws. It's just like a sprawling family, you know, step-parents and stuff. So it's not necessarily a genetic issue. There are people not related to each other who have gotten very, very sick.
Well, now the industry is offering a substitute. It's another toxic chemical known by its proprietary name, Gen X. Does that solve the problem?
So Gen X is a substitute for PFOA, a specific type of PFAS, and that's we looked at that in a community in North Carolina. Now, because it's called a shorter chain PFAS, it's a different makeup. Like PFOA and PFOS, those are the two legacy types of PFAS that even the World Health Organization has deemed PFOA to be carcinogenic and PFOS to be likely. And these have largely been phased out of production, but they're still in the environment because they last forever. So Gen X was one of the replacements that was made and really ended up unleashed into the environment in North Carolina and among other places, but in our book, that's where we focused on. And there's a lot of people sick there too. So we called even the chapter where we focused on this whack-a-mole, because it was like every time you seem like you target one PFAS, another PFAS pops up. And I said Gen X is short chain, but there is now even newer ones that are even tinier called ultra short chain, and they're even able to evade the filtration systems that a lot of cities have now installed. So it's just like you keep solving one problem and a new one comes up. And that's why I said that 15,000 number, it just seems to grow all the time.
And aside from cancer clusters, what are some of the other health problems caused by these chemicals?
There's a lot of cardiovascular issues, reproductive issues in infants, low birth weight. In pregnancy, there can be preeclampsia. The list goes on and on. Reduced vaccine uptake, because there are immunological influences, because there were actually a lot of scientists studying during the pandemic how people with high PFAS exposure, like how they responded to the COVID-19 vaccine, because it was a pretty good test case because so many people were taking the vaccine. And that's another thing, like the number of PFAS types keeps growing, but the number of illnesses that scientists are linking to these compounds keep growing. And see all this, it's really fascinating research, but it's quite scary. Another big one right now is liver disease. Non-fatty liver disease is another one of interest right now. I mean, and I, again, there are more and more and more and more.
Yeah, the immune system one really got me. I mean, for those worried about COVID and bird flu or the measles, just let me quote from this 2021 peer-reviewed paper on perfluoroalkyl substance exposure and immunity. It says, several immunosuppression health outcomes have been studied in association with PFASs, exposure in children, including antibody levels in response to tetanus and diphtheria and measles, mumps, and rubella vaccines, and the risk of severity of infection. So it sounds like just having this stuff in your system can weaken the medical defenses that we have on offer and make the illness worse.
Yes, because they mimic proteins in your blood. It's like they're playing a trick. Like that's essentially what they do to your body. Yeah, it's terrifying.
Zooming out, how far has this chemical blast spread in the world? Are PFASs in most people in most countries?
Yes, and like I said, there were some like fascinating studies that even looked at remote areas. I think there was one in a very rural part of, I think it was in China, that where there was really no way that somebody would be like kind of, I don't want to say naturally, but like exposed to discharges of these compounds or significant quantities of things that would contain them. And still, the areas were tested and they were found there. And that was just one example. There's plenty of others like that. But again, I think one broad application has been military usage, and it's not just the U.S. military. But the U.S. military itself has used it on its bases around the world. For example, in Okinawa in Japan, the U.S. had a base where they were using it. But other armies around the world, too. There was a reason for this jet fuel firefighting foam, because you want to prevent a catastrophic jet fuel-based fire. So most militaries would have it on hand and would be training with it, because it did. I just really do want to emphasize that these chemicals are not just a convenience. They did have use, and they probably saved many lives in that capacity, but then they're also destroying lives as well at the same time.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You were tuned to Radio EcoShock. Our guest is Sharon Udison, author of the new book, Poisoning the Well, How Forever Chemicals Contaminated America. So one peer-reviewed study found PFASs in over 650 different species and counting. We may be making the animals sick so our food doesn't stick to the pan. What have you heard about the animals?
So when I visited Maine, where a lot of dairy businesses have been shuttered due to the widespread usage of sludge on agricultural properties, sludge that contained PFAS but was billed to farmers as like a free fertilizer from the state. The state didn't have a lot of landfilling space, so it was a win-win for everyone, for farmers to accept sludge, the residuals from wastewater treatment. But it was several years ago now, found in the milk of cows, and then their milk was taken off the shelves. It shut down dairy businesses. Some of the farmers I visited with, reported their cows being very sick as well, cancer and stuff. And again, it's very difficult to make definitive links to environmental exposures and specific cancer or disease outcomes. But, I mean, those are circumstantial, reports from farmers that their animals have been quite sick. And there must be a reason that the state of Maine, has no deer hunting because of PFAS in certain areas, because they are assuming that the deer have consumed water that contains PFAS and that people should not be hunting to eat them. The same thing with a lot of fish in the rivers. I visited the Penobscot Nation, which is in central Maine. Their reservation is along the Penobscot River, and a lot of the sludge that has been used across Maine has basically, eventually seeped into rivers and contaminated fish. And these fish in the Penobscot's case are a cultural staple, really, really important. But the state and local governments are issuing, do not eat advisories because they don't want people to get sick. So, yeah, I mean, it depends for fruits and vegetables. It depends on the individual fruit and vegetable. They all uptake the chemicals differently, so it's a big question. These are issues that are still being studied, how much it transfers down the food web, after each thing eats another thing, just how potent it still is once it gets to us, I guess. But it clearly does affect animals.
I did a small check on countries where Radio EcoShock broadcasts outside the United States. Canada has banned some PFAS chemicals, but most of them are still unregulated. The bureaucracy claims to be studying wider controls. In the UK, some PFAS chemicals are restricted, but they are not completely banned. The UK is behind controlling these poisons, but as you write in your book, London's Heathrow Airport has successfully used fluorine-free firefighting foams for years. The EU's a mixed bag. Australia's set to ban the import, export, manufacture, and use of certain PFAS chemicals starting July 1st, coming right up. But they're doing it on a state-by-state basis, I think. So tell us what's happening in the United States. Are these being regulated? Is somebody getting this handled?
Well, so it took decades for any such thing to happen. But finally, in April 2024, former President Biden set his EPA set the country's first federal drinking water standards for PFAS, which was a really pivotal moment. This was for six types of PFAS, and public systems would have until 2029 to fix their issues if they had any. And at the same time, the EPA also designated PFOA and PFOS as hazardous under the CERCLA Superfund cleanup law, which makes it easier to force polluters to clean up or pay for contamination. But fast forward a year later, May 2025, Trump's EPA has decided to rescind and reconsider limits on four of the six PFAS from 2024. They're only going to maintain the regulations for PFOA and PFOS, and the compliance for those two is going to be extended from 2029 to 2031. So now the utilities will have another 2 years to fix their problems. And the other four PFAS that were being regulated by the Biden administration, the Trump administration, said that they are going to reconsider that. And that's PFHXS, which is commonly in firefighting foams, PFNA, Gen X, which you mentioned earlier, and PFBS. And I mean, green groups here are really, really criticizing this move as just a decision to kind of side with companies and continue this persistent pollution problem. But the EPA says that they're just trying to ensure that the determinations and any resulting drinking water regulations, it follows the legal process laid out in the Safe Drinking Water Act. And they're saying that there was a procedural error when the Biden administration created the regulations in 2024. And I could get into that further, but we really don't know what the reconsider is going to do, whether they're just going to kind of ignore and, you know, like kind of not really reconsider anything. Or, I mean, the EPA administrator, he said in a quote, he said, quite frankly, there's a possibility that at the end of this process, a new number could be lower or it could be higher. What we want to do is follow the science, period. So we really have no idea what they're going to do about those four types of PFAS. All we know is that they're maintaining the regulations on PFOA and PFOS, but prolonging the period in which companies can kind of hold out on complying. So that's kind of where the U.S. stands. And so, I mean, I think for a lot of these compounds, the onus is going to be on the individual states. And some states have regulations in place for PFAS or various types, different types from state to state, and some don't. Some are higher than the federal regulations, some were in line with them, but it really now is going to depend on what state you live in.
Are there international rules or regulations for these chemicals?
Not that I know of. I mean, the biggest thing that I heard of, and this is not a rule, was just that the World Health Organization did officially declare PFOA as carcinogenic. But there's no rules or, like, any type of law surrounding their sale across borders.
And the weird thing is you can't dispose of a product that never breaks down. This seems like a permanent addition to the planet, like a mark of our civilization. We thought radiation defined the human era, but maybe it's really PFAS chemicals. Suppose my town installs reverse osmosis technology to really clean the chemicals out of the drinking water. What happens to the captured PFAS stuff?
So there's the municipal systems and then there's in-home systems, because there's also in-home reverse osmosis systems, and some of the companies will take back your filters, and so at least it's not going in the normal trash. But as it stands right now, the municipal systems and the larger companies, they have just a few choices, either to put them in a toxic waste dump or to incinerate in places where that's allowed. But there are, and I always I feel really hopeful about this, because there are actually scientists who are really breaking down these unbreakable compounds right now. And there are some technologies that are already basically developed at pilot scale. I don't want to say they're at full commercial scale, but they're at pilot scale. There's several different types of technologies that are in laboratories across the world, but some of the names are of types of technologies are electrochemical oxidation, low temperature plasma treatment, zonolysis, and then one that I'm really fascinated by is one that's already in pilot stages, and that's called the PFAS annihilator. And it's like they call it a reactor by Revive Environmental, which is a startup of the Battelle Memorial Institute, which is a nonprofit company that works on various scientific issues. And I just find how this works to be really, really fascinating. Basically, a reaction occurs in what's called supercritical water, which is water that's neither liquid nor gas, but has the properties of both under immense pressure and high temperature. And in that both conditions, gases that don't dissolve in water now can do so, and it creates what's called a super solvent fluid that is expandable and compressible, and in which reactions can occur with fewer limits. So oxidants, like air or hydrogen peroxide, can then accept electrons from other substances and are able to catalyze the breakdown of the formidable carbon-fluorine bond. That's that really, really unbreakable bond that really PFAS are known for. And at the end of this process, what's left is PFAS-free water, carbon dioxide, and inert salts. And their goal is to basically bring the PFAS from filtration systems in concentrate, like not just bringing raw contaminated water, because that would be inefficient and very expensive and also could risk spilling everywhere. So when it arrives in concentrate, this type of reactor, which fits in a 20-foot shipping container, can treat like the equivalent of 500,000 gallons of sewage water daily. And there's only a few reactors up and running, but that was just one company. There's a few other startups that also have some pilots going on. And then, like I said, in laboratories and universities like across the world, there's similar such technology underway. So I have some hope about when I hear about those things, looking a little bit toward the light at the end of the tunnel. But then on the other hand, the global magnitude of this problem, like the science is here, but there's going to need to be a lot of money poured into this to really clean up this planetary problem.
Writing this book, Poisoning the Well, you and Rachel Frazen went to the hot spots. You talked to survivors. It sounds a little bit like a horror documentary. Tell us about the PFAS activists in the cancer zones.
So they are actually another component of the story, in addition to the scientists who give me hope, because these are regular people who have shown up. They just have raised their voices, sometimes with death threats coming at them, and they have continued to pursue justice nonetheless. Like, one is Brenda Hampton in northern Alabama. She took both Rachel and I at separate times on what we call the death tour of her northern Alabama community, where we sat in the car with her and she just pointed out left and right, like, how many people died in each house that we passed. And she just, it was so tangible and visual, because this was such a small town of just a few hundred people, and you could see the amount of devastation there. And so could she from the beginning. And she just wouldn't leave that alone and really took it upon herself to kind of bring scientists there, to recruit other activists and to try to make change. And in her case, the change that happened, it wasn't regulatory change because the state of Alabama just has very minimal environmental regulation and probably wouldn't have anything stronger anytime soon. But what she did achieve or helped achieve was a pretty big settlement for her region with 3M, and they ended up with a reverse osmosis treatment system. And obviously that doesn't bring people back who died, but she really was able to achieve a lot in doing so. And I could say the same about all of the other protagonists in this book. They're just truly, you know, impressive people that they're regular people who just saw an injustice and wanted to achieve something positive for their communities that were suffering.
We'll leave it there with the heroes who stepped up. From Colorado, we've been speaking with Hill reporter and author Sharon Udasin. Look for her new book, It's Poisoning the Well, How Forever Chemicals Contaminated America. You can find out more at SharonUdasin.com or follow the links in my blog at ecoshock.org. Sharon, thank you for this chilling read and for talking with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
How can we persuade people climate change is a stupendously real tidal wave that we need to quickly seek higher ground? What can we say to the workmate or uncle who denies it? The friend who agrees but does nothing? Seeking answers, intelligent people methodically tested strategies, tools we might call interventions. On May 13th, on the top journal PNAS, their results appear in the paper Behavioral Interventions Motivate Climate Action to Address Climate Change. Let's shop for tested tools we can all use. The lead author is Alyssa H. Sinclair, known to all as Allie. She is a postdoc at the University of Pennsylvania. Allie won her PhD at Duke University in psychology and neuroscience. Her co-authors include Emily Falk and Michael Mann. From Philadelphia, Allie Sinclair, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, Alex. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, some listeners discovered intervention through a dramatic TV series about families trying to rescue addicts. What do you mean by intervention when you're talking about the climate struggle?
Yeah, that's a great question. When I talk about interventions here, I'm using it in a psychological sense. You know, sometimes we might think about clinical interventions, like you just described, for someone who's struggling with addiction, but we can also think about behavioral interventions in a much broader sense, about how we can sort of nudge people to try to change their behavior, for example, in a way that might be better for their health, or in this case, to take action in ways that are better for the environment and to address climate change. So we're talking about simple, non-pharmaceutical interventions that we can do just by talking to people or having them think about something in a way that we think sort of targets processes of how they think and how their brains work to change their behavior.
Wow, pharmaceutical interventions for climate change sounds like an interesting topic for another day. All right, now you begin with three major barriers to sharing climate info and acting on it. Could you take a couple of minutes to lay those out for us? What stops us?
Sure. So in the psychological literature, we can think of a number of factors that might prevent people from taking action to address climate change. And first, I think it's important to acknowledge that a majority of people do believe that climate change is happening. So about 72% of people in the U.S., about 85% of people worldwide, they all acknowledge that climate change is happening and might be pretty worried about it. Of course, the number of people who agree that it's entirely caused by humans might be a little lower, but still, that's a lot of people who acknowledge that we have a problem, and yet many of them are probably not taking action in daily life or talking about it with other people. So what might be sort of creating that gap between belief and action? And there are a few different things that emerge over and over again in the psychological literature. One barrier is distance. So climate change can feel like a problem that's really remote and far away on a number of dimensions. It can be temporally far away, so you think that we won't feel the effects of climate change for a really long time. It's hard to project into the future. Another way that it can be distant is geographically. So you might think that your daily life in your local area might not change very much. Perhaps you think that countries that are far away in the global south will be more impacted by climate change, and so you won't see the effects where you are. And the third type of distance, which is related to that, is self-relevance. So if you think that people like you and you yourself personally won't be really impacted by climate change, then you might feel that it's a very distant problem. In addition to that barrier of distance, there is another barrier that has to do with sort of our perception of relevance, both to us and to people we care about. So we might feel that climate change is not really something that's relevant to you right now. And you can also sometimes underestimate what other people think about climate change and how much support there might be. This is a problem we call pluralistic ignorance, which means underestimating the proportion of other people out there who might hold the same beliefs that you do. So if I assume that I care about climate change, but the people around me don't, I might be hesitant to speak out or take action because I assume that other people wouldn't agree. But that's not true. We know that many people actually do hold these similar beliefs. And so one strategy is potentially to try to increase people's understanding of how many people care about climate change to try to motivate action. The third and final barrier that we addressed in this paper has to do with what we call response efficacy, or our beliefs about whether or not our actions actually matter. So some people might not take action because they believe that individuals don't have the power to do anything, or they might be desiring to take action but not know how to do so effectively. So they feel like they don't have the instructions or know which actions would matter most. So in our tournament, we developed a number of different intervention strategies that tried to target these three main psychological barriers. And we group them under three themes that correspond to those barriers. So we call those themes relevance, where we try to emphasize why climate change is relevant to you and to people you care about. Future thinking, where we try to help people project into the future to understand what climate change could look like and how it could happen to impact them or their local area. And finally, response efficacy theme, where we try to help people understand that their actions do matter and direct them towards the actions that matter most.
When I looked at a quick summary of interlocking aspects of climate information and activism in Figure 2 of your paper, the key to me seemed to be, tell me how climate change is about me. How can we make climate outreach more personal so it sticks?
Yes, you'll notice that many of the interventions that we tested touch on self or social relevance in some way. So helping people relate climate change to themselves and to people they care about, like young people in their lives. And we see that this is quite an effective strategy, not only for getting people to share information about climate change, like news articles and petitions, but also that when you guide people to imagine the future and also emphasize self or social relevance, that's a really effective way to motivate people to change behavior in daily life. So both as a standalone strategy and also by pairing it with other strategies, I think appealing to self and social relevance can be really effective.
And some of the best results came not from shaming people, but imagining the future. As a specialist in neuroscience and psychology, why is future thinking so powerful?
That's a great question and one of my specialties. So our brains are actually very good at something that we call mental time travel. So the same system in the brain, centered around a region called the hippocampus, helps us sort of travel in time to recollect and re-experience the past when we draw on our memories. But it also uses that same process to imagine future or hypothetical scenarios, helping us project into the future and imagine what might be, which can be good or bad when we imagine those situations, but it's really useful either way to guide our behavior. So if we anticipate what the future outcomes of our choices might be, we can make better choices now in order to avoid bad things in the future or to try to strive towards more positive future outcomes. So in the brain, we know that engaging this system can be really beneficial. We call this episodic simulation or episodic future thinking. And when you activate that brain region that's used both for memory and for imagination, you can not only help people make more patient, future-oriented decision-making, but you can also get them to take fewer risks, be a little bit more rational or more patient. You can get them to make better financial decisions, for example, being willing to invest in future outcomes. You can also use this kind of method to get people to engage in pro-social behavior. So if you get people to imagine future outcomes, like for somebody who's in need, that can get them to want to help that person or donate to a cause. So we've seen a lot of varieties of applications here, and it's all centered around that brain system that is good both for recalling the past and for imagining the future.
And your team discusses imagination exercises as a good tool. Could you give us an example?
Sure. So one of the leading interventions in our tournament when it came to motivating action involved a guided imagination exercise where you visualized what it would be like to experience a negative future due to climate change. And this was a self-relevant future, so you imagined yourself immersed in the scenario. We did this online. It only takes about 5 minutes, so it's pretty accessible. But basically, we have a series of prompts that we give people in writing where we ask them to imagine a scene that takes place in a future city that's been negatively impacted due to climate change. So this is a very hot and polluted city. There are a lot of cars spewing exhaust, people who are angry and honking, a lot of, dying plants and drought and problems like that. We give them some details to start to sort of scaffold this imagination, but then we allow them to fill in the details themselves, and we prompt them to close their eyes and to vividly imagine the scenario using all of their senses. So what they might see, hear, smell, and feel, what it would be like emotionally to be immersed in that scene. And we sort of walk them through it step by step. So they first imagine sort of the broader context of this city, more of like an overhead view of what it would be like. Then they imagine being immersed in the scene, walking down a sidewalk in this city. They imagine the people around them, the cars. You know, what are the people doing? What is it like to spend a day in this life? And then imagining the physical sensations and the emotions that they might feel. So we try to walk them through the scenario in a number of different ways where we sort of alternate between giving them a short prompt and having them close their eyes and imagine in as much detail as they can. Then they open their eyes and type into a box to describe what they imagine so that we can confirm that they're engaging with the task.
And you also looked into what doesn't work. I mean, for example, who invented the carbon footprint strategy and does that work?
Yeah, so there was one intervention that we tested that we did not think was very likely to work. Everything else we chose was based on solid theoretical foundation, where we thought it had a really good chance of working. But there was one that we didn't think would work, but we felt that we had to test it anyway, and that's the carbon footprints intervention. Now, carbon footprints were actually invented by BP, British Petroleum, who you might imagine has a bit of an interest in distracting from decarbonization and motivating people to take individual action in a way that sort of shifts the blame or attention away from oil and gas companies. And so this tool was popularized by BP many years ago, and since then has really taken off and been used widely. Currently, it's promoted by reputable agencies like the EPA, as well as the World Wildlife Fund. They have their own carbon footprints that they direct people toward. And this seems appealing on the surface to get tailored, personalized feedback about your carbon footprint and ways that you can take action to change it. But there's really hardly any empirical evidence testing whether or not the strategy works, despite the fact that it's so widely used and it's not really based in sound theory. So we felt that it was important to include this intervention in our tournament and see whether or not it works, and particularly whether there are better strategies that would be sort of a better use of our time and energy. And what we found was that the carbon footprint intervention really didn't work for any of our outcomes. It didn't backfire, but it didn't have any positive effect on motivating action or on getting people to want to share information about climate change. It did increase the perceived impact of climate action. So people who learned about their carbon footprint felt that they had, there were ways that they could take action that might be meaningful. And yet there was this gap where despite them feeling like actions might matter, they were not actually more motivated to engage in those actions in the future. So it seems that it's sort of something that might seem positive on the surface, but is not actually a very effective strategy to try to get people to change their behavior in the longer term.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is Dr. Ali Sinclair from Penn, and our topic is what really works to communicate the climate challenge. There was a huge international study published in 2024, led by Madalena Vascanu at Stanford. It involved almost 60,000 participants from 63 countries, and it used a tournament approach. Does your new study build on this, or how is yours different?
Yeah, we are big fans of that mega study that was conducted by Madalena Vascanu and colleagues. One strength of that prior study is that they also, like we did, used an intervention tournament approach, which means that you get to test many different theoretical predictions, many different ideas, all at the same time in a big sample, and then you can really compare them head-to-head because you've got the exact same outcome measures as a kind of common currency. And a benefit of this approach, which we also use, is that it shifts the question from being, does it work or not, to what's the most effective strategy and why. So it really is a great way to test a lot of ideas and find the most optimal communication strategies. But there were a couple of things that were different from their tournament to ours, and I think ours really builds on theirs in a meaningful way and introduces some new ideas and new findings. So first off, almost all of the interventions that we tested were different from what they did in their tournament. Second, they took a different approach where they crowdsourced intervention ideas, which led to some really interesting things that they tested, but also was a little less systematic. So we took a more theory-driven approach where we started with some existing theories about different ways of changing behavior and different barriers that are present that might prevent people from acting to try to address climate change. And we sort of systematically brainstormed interventions that would target those barriers. So we took a bit of a different approach in terms of deciding on what interventions to include. We also had different sampling approaches. So in the prior tournaments, this was a global study. So they recruited people from many different countries. This was a huge team effort. And one pro of that is that they are able to investigate cross-cultural differences, which is really useful for people who might want to think about how they could tailor interventions to different cultural contexts or different communities or groups of people. In contrast, in our study, we focused on the U.S., which means that we don't have as much generalizability to a global context, but does mean that we can do a deeper dive on things like, for example, political polarization within the U.S. and how it relates to climate change. Another important thing to note is in terms of our outcome measures, we had a different set of outcome measures, and there was also some findings from the prior study that revealed some really important gaps and challenges for future research, which we helped to address. So in that prior work, they found that none of their interventions effectively motivated climate action, and in fact, several of them backfired. So, for example, one of the leading strategies that they found for motivating people to share information about climate change was negative emotion induction, or, you know, scaring people, essentially. And even though that worked for getting people to want to share information, it actually backfired when it came to climate action. So that reveals the importance of testing new, different strategies that might motivate action without potentially being demoralizing, leading to catastrophizing, and things like that. And so in our study, we tested alternative strategies with a sort of complementary set of outcome measures, and we found some strategies that did effectively increase intentions to take action without backfiring on other outcomes like information sharing.
Ali, I want to dip back into a 2021 neuroscience paper you published in PNAS. After stipulating predictions of the future are built on memories of the past, you investigate the role of surprise or error. Now, it seems to me crazy weather these days has lots of surprises. We all expected this to happen much later, and we've never seen such damaging events before. Ask the people in Asheville, Carolina. So when we realize the reality of climate, or we get shocked by an emergency, do our brains need to go back and rearrange our memories?
That's a great question, and that relates back to the ideas that I shared previously about how our brains kind of time travel in order to guide our decisions and our behavior in a way that makes sense to help us kind of keep pace with the changing world. So that same memory system centered on the hippocampus that allows us to recall the past and imagine the future also helps us learn from our mistakes. So when we predict that something will happen based on our past experiences and it's surprising, it doesn't turn out the way that we expected, that brain region sort of responds to that surprise and it creates an opportunity for us to revise our knowledge and change our behavior accordingly. So that can help us adapt when we find that things are not the way that they were before and things are changing. So surprise is a really useful catalyst that can help us learn and update our beliefs and can also motivate us to change our behavior.
And your 2021 study also found memories created by curiosity stay with us longer and more clearly compared to memories formed during high stress events. So creating urgency might actually decrease memory about climate science compared to luring people in with curiosity?
Yes, I think you might be talking about the 2023 PNAS paper there. Sorry, I know there are a few. It's a little confusing. But yes, in another study, we looked at how different motivational states, for example, emphasizing urgency or trying to evoke a more curious and future-oriented sort of exploratory mindset, how those different motivational states would change the way people learn and make decisions, and then the details of what they remember in the future. We've actually applied some of those theoretical insights from that paper to news headlines about climate change really recently. We have a preprint up that's currently on SciArchive, which is a preprint platform, where we took a bunch of news headlines about climate change and we created alternate versions of those headlines where we tried to evoke these different motivational states. So sometimes we really tried to emphasize crisis and urgency, sort of upping the ante about a story, whereas in other cases we took the same underlying news story and we wrote an alternate headline that tried to evoke a bit more of a future-oriented, action-oriented, or curious mindset. So focusing on solutions or what people are doing to address a problem. And what we found was that both of those strategies can increase engagement, so increasing people's willingness to read and share that information. But there's also a really interesting trade-off, where in the moment, if you emphasize crisis, that can be more effective for getting people to read and share information and also to make real charitable donations to related causes. But the next day, if you bring them back, they actually have worse memory for the details of that news content that they read. In contrast, when you try to evoke a more future-oriented or curious mindset, we find that it's, you know, still pretty good at increasing engagement in the moment, and the next day they actually have enhanced memory for the content of that information. And so we think this is really useful, especially in the context of climate change, to think about these pros and cons to different emotional or motivational framing strategies. Because sometimes we do want people to sort of wake up and take action in the moment, but we also know that when it comes to long-term problems like climate change, it's not enough to just act in the moment and then be done with it. You know, this is a chronic problem that requires sustained action, retaining information, and sort of striving towards future goals. And so inducing a more positive and future-oriented motivational state might be more useful in cases like that.
So millions of people spend more time in cyberspace than they do on the ground. Is it enough to be an information warrior reaching people's cyber persona, or do we need physical meetings and rallies and gatherings? Ali, do we need a new strategy to reach both the person and their net persona?
Mm-hmm. I think these are complementary approaches to do online interventions as well as in-person rallies and other activities. So one benefit of taking an online approach is that information spreads so rapidly and so widely. So we can tap into these social networks, for example, by getting people to read and share information about climate change, and that can sort of propagate to reach many different people and change social norms. So if I start seeing that many people in my social network are talking about climate change and sharing news headlines about climate change or expressing their opinion, that might make me feel less alone, and perhaps I then have the courage to do the same. And so this is kind of a self-perpetuating effect that can really potentially have a lot of benefit. But at the same time, we also know that in-person gatherings can be really motivating. It can make people feel that they're a part of a sort of a social movement that might be really compelling and encouraging. And so having this kind of in-person activity, which can, you know, get attention for policymakers and also gain momentum to help people build community and build resilience to support tackling this long-term challenge, I think that's very important as well.
One of the design purposes of your program at Penn, where Professor Michael Mann has a leadership role as well, is to draw the whole university into helping to solve the climate crisis. We need more than just meteorologists and climate scientists. We need economists and historians and psychologists and many more. But neuroscientists too?
Well, I certainly hope so. I think neuroscientists have a different perspective to offer. By thinking about the way our brains work, we can sometimes generate new and surprising predictions about what psychological strategies might be most effective. Like, for example, with the work that I mentioned before about the crisis and urgency framing leading to memory impairment for the details that they read, that's a prediction that wouldn't necessarily come from the communication literature, but does make sense when you think about neuroscience and how negative emotion or sort of an urgent motivational state engages a particular brain system that leads to these trade-offs that we see in behavior. So that's one example of how bringing a neuroscience perspective can be really enlightening, I think. But yes, as you mentioned, I'm part of the Penn Center for Science, Sustainability, and the Media, which is led by Michael Mann. And one key goal of the center is to bring together interdisciplinary groups to bring all of those unique perspectives from across different literatures, across different training backgrounds, in order to tackle this multifaceted problem of climate change and improve communication.
So wrapping it up, if I'm part of an environmental group or just a personal activist, can you give us a couple of strategies to reach more people and get them contacting politicians or building low-carbon towns?
I think the number one take-home idea from our tournament would be that if you can phrase your news or calls to action in a way that guides people to imagine the future, especially when you make it relevant to themselves and people they personally care about, then that's going to be an effective way to motivate people to want to engage, to take action, and also to try to get them to spread the word and share that information with other people, which is useful for these sort of broader network effects.
Allie Sinclair, what are you working on next?
We're currently working on a number of studies that sort of extend on the findings from our intervention tournament. So one limitation of what we did so far is that we focus on intentions. So we look at a variety of actions, like individual actions, including eating less meat, driving less, or flying less, as well as collective actions, like contacting your representatives or participating in protests and things like that. But we are just looking at sort of future intentions to engage in those things. The end goal is to directly measure actual behavior in the real world and over time to follow up with people. So in ongoing studies, we're doing that right now. And we're also exploring how we can try to bridge the partisan divide when it comes to climate change in the U.S. And we're looking at our existing data as well as new data that we're collecting to try to see which strategies are most effective for reaching conservatives, which is not always the same strategy as sort of the overall number one leaders in our tournament.
From the University of Pennsylvania, we've been speaking with postdoctoral researcher Alyssa H. Sinclair. She leads a May 2025 study in PNAS called Behavioral Interventions Motivate Action to Address Climate Change. It is a goldmine for what works in climate activism, I think. You can find free links to this open source paper in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Allie, thank you for sharing time with our listeners.
Thank you.
Step out of the cloud, my friends, and into the green. I'm Alex. Thank you for continuing to feed your mind, for going deep when the world gets shallow. Thank you for caring.